Welcome. I'm your host, Dr. Laura Pfeiffer, and I am a naturopathic doctor helping you take your hormones from chaos to calm. In this podcast, I'm searching the internet, mainly Reddit, to find out what you are talking about. I'm diving into the questions you have, the things you are too embarrassed to talk about, and helping you navigate our healthcare system with ease. This is Healthy Hormones with Dr. Laura. Hello. Welcome to another episode. I recorded this episode and I re-recorded it because I didn't have the proper connections for my computer and the audio wasn't great and the video wasn't great and I wanted to make it a little bit better, especially because I was only a couple weeks into having this new format, if you will, and I just couldn't do it. And then my kids got sick and I got sick and, you know, here we are, mom of two under three. This is what happens. But I thought this topic was important enough to re-record. So I wanted to take the time to talk about it today. We're going to talk about something that I talk to my patients about all the time. These are my patients who are in perimenopause, or maybe they are in full-blown menopause and they have worsening digestive issues. And a lot of the times the question is, well, why are things getting worse? So this Reddit thread we are talking about today is called Going Nuts: GI issues, IBS, food sensitivities, intense health anxiety. Hi all, I'm 50, still getting irregular periods, but I think I've been in perimenopause for a few years at this point. Until recently, I've been super lucky and that things have been pretty mild for me. Irregular periods and increasing anxiety were probably the most obvious things. But then I'd say mild, occasional GI issues, a little brain stuff like forgetting names, etc. Nothing terrible. As far as the GI issues went, if I cut out caffeine and sometimes decreased dairy for a week or two, that would generally take care of it. Then several weeks ago, seemingly out of the blue, my digestive system just seemed to go crazy, and intense health anxiety came along with it. The digestive stuff has been very gradually improving, but things are still wonky and the anxiety just won't let up. I'm on anti-anxiety meds and antidepressants and seeing both a therapist and a psychiatrist regularly, but some days it feels like too much. It's very obvious that the anxiety and GI issues are closely connected. They might not even be separate things. Days when the anxiety is stronger, the GI issues are worse. And when I have a better mental health day, I also have a better GI day. I need to avoid Dr. Google. I try and do it less. I was, but it's hard. Sorry for the huge post. I guess I mostly just need to vent. And if anyone has some reassurance or commiseration to offer, I'd take that too. So this poster I thought was really interesting and I wanted to cover it in an episode because I see this all the time in my practice. This is something that is very common. I see someone in perimenopause. Maybe they've had a history of IBS. Maybe they've literally never had digestive issues in their life, but they come to me saying, Laura, for some reason my IBS is flared up since I've entered perimenopause, or my digestion has just become a wreck ever since my period started changing. So let's start at the beginning and talk about what is IBS, because in my opinion, IBS is a little bit of a lazy diagnosis because it is kind of the diagnosis you get when there's nothing else that they can figure out what's going on. There's nothing structural. Maybe you've had some, you know, maybe you've had a scope done and that's come back clear. And so you don't have Crohn's, you don't have colitis, you don't have celiac. And they're like, that's IBS. See you later. And there's really no solutions that are offered. So we'll talk a little bit about what those solutions are and why I don't feel like they're solutions. But irritable bowel syndrome is characterized by a recurrent abdominal disorder or pain with at least two of the following characteristics. It has a relation to defecation, so a relation to when you're going to the washroom. There's an association with a change in the frequency of stool, or association with the change in consistency of stool. The cause is not known, and the pathophysiology is incompletely understood. The diagnosis is clinical. Treatment is symptomatic, consisting of dietary management and drugs, including anticholinergics, agents active at the serotonin receptors. So that's the definition from Merck manuals of what IBS is. And so just to kind of lay it out there, that's what the definition is. Now, a lot of research has actually linked IBS to a few different things. In my practice, I link IBS to what I refer to as dysbiosis. Dysbiosis is basically an imbalance in your good and bad bacteria. So what does that mean? Dysbiosis is you have bacteria growing maybe in the wrong spots, maybe in the wrong amounts. Sometimes there is what I refer to as commensal bacteria. So bacteria that's supposed to be there, but maybe it's there in larger quantities than it should be, or maybe it's there in the wrong spot. So in the case of SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, we see a lot of bacteria that usually we would see in the large intestine, the fermenters in the small intestine. So we just see a changing of space of where the bacteria is and where it should normally be. Now let's bring it back to menopause and say, okay, how is this relevant? Let's talk about the transition from, you know, before menopause to menopause. So the menopausal transition is characterized initially by menstrual cycle changes, alterations in estrogen and progesterone levels, and then ultimately we stop bleeding. And so menopause is defined as no period for 1 year. This can be very frustrating because in the perimenopausal state, you might be going from, you know, 3 months without a period, and then 2 months without a period, and then 1 month without a period. And then, you know, you're like, oh, is this it? And it's not it. You are not done, right? And then you have a period, and then you're like, okay, well now the clock starts again. And it feels like there's no support in between that clock, right? It's like your doctor says, well, come back to me when you don't have a period anymore, when you're in menopause. But that can take up to 10 years. And so, interestingly enough, there's actually a higher prevalence of IBS, or known functional dyspepsia symptoms, in women versus men. And so we know there has to be a hormonal component because we know that there is a higher amount in women. Interestingly, there was a higher mucosal immune activation found in women with IBS compared to men with IBS, and mast cell infiltration was related to greater abdominal bloating and dysmotility-like dyspepsia symptoms in women with IBS. So when they compared, you know, it wasn't apples to apples. They found more mucosal immune activation in women, and we know that things like IBS are more common in women. So we start to kind of put these pieces together. A recent study looked at women's health across the nation, and they found that gut permeability actually increased from premenopause to postmenopause. The increase in permeability was associated with a systemic inflammatory marker. And so what does this mean? It means that there's a lot of things happening from, you know, that cycling phase into perimenopause and that postmenopause stage. And part of what happens is hormones go down. I'm going to talk about the link between hormones and your gut specifically. But one of the things that happens is we have an increase in permeability of the gut. This is actually referred to as, I'm going to put in quotations, leaky gut, right? And so what does leaky gut mean? It's an increase in permeability of the gut. And this allows, especially when we're dealing with food and things like that, this allows parts of the food that wouldn't normally interact with your immune system because it would be blocked off by the gut to actually go through and interact with your immune system and have a systemic reaction. And so sometimes what we see is, oh, I suddenly have all these food sensitivities. I suddenly am reacting to all of these things. Ask yourself, what age am I at? What are my hormones doing? Because your gut has increased in permeability. Now, if you had a pre-existing leaky gut situation that was going on, now it's going to be even worse at this point. So there was an increase in permeability. And not only was there an increase in permeability, that increase was correlated or associated with a systemic inflammatory marker, CRP. So I see a lot of women who are like, I just have inflammation. I have these inflammatory markers, whether they've had ESR or CRP or both graded, or what am I trying to say? They've had it in blood work and it's elevated. And they're like, why is this happening? This can be related to the changes from pre to postmenopause. Menopause. I don't know why I said it like that. There was an interesting link between younger women, oral contraceptives, and IBS. This doesn't have to do with menopause, but this brought up a couple thoughts for me. So I thought it would be interesting to tack onto this conversation because I'm saying the hormones are, or the lack of hormones can be impacting the IBS, you know, picture we have in menopause. So basically they looked at the relationship between medication-related sex hormones and symptoms in younger women. They found that women with IBS who used oral contraceptives had reduced monthly abdominal pain symptoms compared to those not using oral contraceptives. Additionally, a review looking at both animals and younger women suggested that pharmacological suppression of ovarian hormones can reduce abdominal pain symptoms, which was very interesting because it begs the question, and the reason why it's interesting is because they're concluding that reducing hormones, so reducing your ovarian hormones, because if you're not aware, birth control shuts off your systems. So it suppresses your ability to make hormones, and then it supplements you with hormones. So there is hormones involved in oral contraceptives. It's just a matter of they're very, very controlled and they're synthetic. They're not your natural hormones, you know, doing their thing in the pattern that they would normally do them. So it's saying, on one hand, in younger women, being on oral contraceptives, i.e. shutting off their normal hormones, is helpful for regulating IBS symptoms, okay? But then they're saying in menopause, where hormones are naturally low, naturally not there, women have worsening IBS issues. And so it just made me, again, this is just my thoughts surrounding this issue, is on one hand, it's like, okay, maybe it has more to do with the other pieces that go on, because, for example, in someone who is cycling, they're not going to necessarily have the increased permeability happen that happens in menopause. So there are other factors other than just the hormones. The other thing I think about is when we're in menopause and perimenopause, the hormones are low for sure, but they also are sometimes fluctuating. So sometimes in menopause, perimenopause, that, you know, things are transitioning, we're not necessarily having low and low consistently. Things are kind of going a little bit wonky. And then if we compare that to someone who is taking birth control, we say, okay, well, why are you taking birth control? Usually it's not for birth control. Usually it is painful periods, heavy periods, whatever the case may be. And the reason why I say that is because then it brings me to the conclusion of, okay, so maybe before they went on birth control, their periods were wonky, their hormones were, again, like this, all out of control. Then they went on birth control to shut off their hormones, because we don't want to deal with that. And now they're being given a very precise, consistent level of hormone, and that made it better. So I'm wondering if it's not that hormonal birth control actually helps the gut, but it just, you know, gets rid of the wonkiness that was going on with the hormones before. Now, I could be wrong in that theory, but that's what I would conclude when looking at that information. So I just thought it was interesting to bring up. Okay, how do hormones impact your gut health? So there are a number of ways in which hormones can impact the gut. Hormones impact how quickly food moves through the intestines. When estrogen and progesterone decrease, you can actually get constipation and diarrhea. Estrogen and progesterone help how food moves through the digestive tract, as well as how quickly. Estrogen and progesterone contribute to the body's ability to produce stomach acid and bile. So those are huge. If you're not making stomach acid, you're not going to break down your food properly. You're not going to absorb nutrients properly. You're not going to digest fat. So without bile, you can actually have trouble absorbing essential fat-soluble vitamins, so A, D, E, K, which that in itself can worsen symptoms, can worsen, you know, mood and things like that. We know vitamin D plays a huge role. Estrogen actually can increase the vulnerability of women to develop IBS compared with men. However, the actual fluctuations in ovarian hormones may be more related to changes in pain and non-painful symptoms and pain sensitivity with the menstrual cycle. So basically they're saying that yes, estrogen can increase, and this comes back to this fluctuation I'm talking about, right? Estrogen can increase the ability to develop, or the vulnerability to develop IBS, but it could be that the fluctuations in ovarian hormones actually leave you susceptible to pain. So with IBS, a lot of people will have urgency, cramping, abdominal pain. And they're saying that depending on where you're at in the cycle, the hormones may be influencing the pain rather than the IBS itself. But let's talk about menopause and the microbiome, because we know now that in menopause and perimenopause, you're more likely to have IBS. We know there's some hormonal changes, and we know hormones can impact the gut. Now let's talk about menopause and hormones in the microbiome. So research has shown there's significant associations of menopause status with the gut microbiome. So basically, when you're in menopause, we've shown reductions in gut microbiome diversity, alterations in overall composition, and a depletion of certain bacteria. Now, I always talk about, when I'm talking about gut health, one of the things I always mention is diversity, because having good bacteria is important, but having diversity is the most important piece when we're looking at digestive health. And so having a diverse community is more important than having the one, you know, bacteria in itself. So with menopause, we actually see a reduction in microbiome diversity, which is going to lead you vulnerable to gut issues. Also, looking at the gut microbiome in observed between post and premenopausal women, we saw a depletion of female hormones driving microbiome changes, and menopause-related gut species and functions influence serum levels of progestin or vice versa. They also found that menopause-related species were associated with cardiometabolic profiles in postmenopause, suggesting an adverse effect of menopause-related gut microbiome alterations on metabolic syndrome risk. What does this mean? It's that you can have gut microbiome changes in menopause because of your hormone changes that can lead to an increased risk of metabolic syndrome, cardiovascular disease, that sort of thing. Okay, and then this study also found a few interesting things about microbiome diversity, which I said was a problem. So, where is it? So, total urinary estrogens were positively associated with gut microbial diversity. Similarly, serum estradiol was associated with increased gut microbial diversity, but this did not account for menstrual cycle timing. The use of oral contraceptives, which decrease estradiol and progesterone, was associated with a decreased microbiome diversity. So what am I saying here? Again, back to the fact that if you're on, and actually this brings me back to an interesting point that I was saying about the younger women on oral contraceptives, because what I was saying with that is I was believing, my theory was that it was because we actually had more stable hormones rather than having like shutting off the system. And this kind of further proves my point that being on birth control reduces microbiome diversity, which isn't good, right? So we're not talking about being on oral contraceptives helps your IBS and makes everything better. There's also a lot of other pieces to that puzzle. So I just don't think it's that cut and dry. Let's talk about the estrobilome. So this is part of the managing estrogen metabolism. So basically, if you don't have the type of bacteria and fungi that make up the estrobilome, you won't break down estrogen. It's important because if estrogen isn't broken down and metabolized, it can't be used to do its job, which contributes to cognitive function, mood regulation, skin, hair health, and protecting against heart disease. If estrogen isn't metabolized, it gets stored in the body, and that's when estrogen can be toxic. If your cells don't use it, it's stored in tissue, and that can actually lead to cancer. The estrobilome also transforms estrogen into its usable form. So it's not just about getting rid of estrogen and metabolizing estrogen, it's also about getting it into a usable form so the body can use it. If you don't have the proper bacteria to help with that estrobilome, then that's going to hinder all of the actions that estrogen does. Let's talk about the link between mental health and digestive health. So now we know we have, with menopause, we have an increased risk of IBS. We know that microbiome changes happen in menopause as a result of the hormone changes. So now, how does that relate to your mental health? So research that I looked into was interesting because it said stress exposure, including adverse early childhood events, is proposed as a key factor accounting for the development and maintenance of pain and disability. For instance, participants with IBS and higher levels of daily psychosocial distress show increased visceral sensitivity to pain. For many women, midlife is characterized by multiple co-occurring stressors such as marital and parenting issues, caretaking for children and parents, work-family imbalances, health problems, deaths, possible frustrated goal attainment, financial insecurity. Such stressful lives make midlife for women more vulnerable to psychological distress. Additionally, a review suggests adverse early life experiences can increase susceptibility to psychological distress for women during midlife. So we know, sorry, I keep kicking my camera if you're watching. We know that these things can happen as a result of a predisposition, right? Being in a situation early in life that proves you to be vulnerable to these things. Now let's talk about how the gut-brain axes can kind of worsen this scenario. Because I always say when you have a condition, there has to be a pre-existing risk factor, and then there's a trigger, right? There's something that pairs it together to create the outcome. Because there's a reason why not everyone experiences every single thing. Not every single individual that goes through menopause has mental health issues. Not every single person has IBS. Obviously, there's a lot of other things going on. It's not every single person that goes through menopause has these hormonal changes, therefore has anxiety and IBS. But this is just a way in which these can develop. So let's talk about the gut-brain axes, or the brain-gut axes. The brain-gut axis, which bidirectionally communicates between the central nervous system through the autonomic nervous system and the enteric nervous system, is a known pathway that regulates gastrointestinal function. Stress perceptions can actually disrupt the brain-gut axis, alter the motility, secretion, visceral sensation, and trigger or exacerbate IBS symptoms. So this makes sense. You're like, yeah, the last time I was stressed, I got constipated, or when I had to write a test, I got anxiety and I got diarrhea, right? All of these things, you're like, oh yeah, we talk about, you know, being stressed and having to go to the washroom. This is very much correlated. The sympathovagal balance of the autonomic nervous system participates in the regulation of gastrointestinal function, including motility, secretion, and gut barrier function, can induce anxiety. As shown in meta-analyses, the autonomic nervous system function as measured by heart rate variability is altered in adults with IBS and relates to abdominal pain and motility disturbances. In addition, there is some evidence linking autonomic nervous system with gut permeability and inflammation, both thought to contribute to IBS pathophysiology in at least a subset of people. So, what have we linked here now? The autonomic nervous system in your gut, linked with gut permeability and inflammation, which we've already talked about, is increased in menopause, right? We've seen that in menopause, you're more likely to have leaky gut or increased gut permeability. Increasingly, dysbiosis and leaky gut due to psychosocial stress through the brain-gut axes are proposed as mechanisms that may account for the diverse pain-related symptoms in a subset of patients with overlapping pain symptoms. Psychosocial distress is considered a valuable target for IBS symptom management because we can see how the brain-gut axes can contribute to all of these other pieces, right? So we have menopause over here. We have the hormonal changes causing issues in the microbiome. We have the microbiome issues causing IBS. We also have the changes in the hormones causing leaky gut and psychosocial stress worsening that and being a bidirectional communicator causing issues. So I wanted to talk about some dietary strategies and talk about whether it's a friend or foe situation, because there was an article I was reading and I had a couple qualms with it. Let's talk about what the dietary strategies entail, and also understanding if you have a gut issue or a food issue. So from the article, they said many patients with IBS as well as other functional gastrointestinal disorders, including functional dyspepsia, report their symptoms are triggered by diet. Different dietary strategies have also been suggested to alleviate symptoms. Although dietary strategies are often perceived as having fewer side effects than medications, dietary modifications may lead to increased cost, inconvenience, or potential unintended consequences. One such unintended consequence is that individuals with IBS may have an underlying eating disorder, such as avoidant or restrictive food intake disorder. Therefore, it's recommended that patients be screened for eating disorders prior to engaging in dietary restrictions. And one of these diets that they recommend is the low FODMAP diet. I don't like recommending that diet because, again, if we go back to the root causes of IBS, oftentimes there's a post-infectious cause, so kind of never well since an infection. There's possibly a dysbiosis, so an imbalance in good and bad bacteria, and there's possibly SIBO. What do all of these three conditions have in common? Bacteria is out of whack in your gut. Either you have an overgrowth, there is, you know, something, if you had post-infectious, maybe you have an overgrowth of candida or H. pylori, or maybe there's a parasite. All of them have a dysbiosis. All of them are saying your gut bugs are not happy. And so what happens is when we eat foods that are high FODMAP, and so what does that look like? There's a huge list, if you look anywhere online, of foods and, you know, FODMAPs, right? Things that are low FODMAP and high FODMAP. Basically, when we're taking away these foods, it's because there's a certain amount of food that is high FODMAP that will be fermented by certain bacteria that are going to worsen symptoms. They're going to lead to gas and bloating, right? For example, broccoli at a certain level is low FODMAP, but at a higher level is a higher FODMAP, right? Based on the amount. Some foods are based on the amount. Other foods are just the foods themselves. What I'm saying is we're really just symptom management if we're doing a low FODMAP diet, right? We're putting ourselves back in symptom management mode because we're not actually getting rid of the root cause. Plus, a low FODMAP diet is extremely restrictive. And so if we're taking away a lot of the foods, we're really pigeonholing ourselves into a lifestyle that's not sustainable. So I would say most of the time, there is a gut issue, not a food issue. So if you're finding that you're the person who is allergic to everything, quote unquote, like every food makes you bloated, or you just can't pinpoint what the cause is, or you feel sick with everything, it seems, then it's more likely that you have a gut issue going on rather than a food issue. Based on evidence, bacterial, viral, and parasitic infections can actually trigger IBS. So the role of the gut microbiome is the forefront, as opposed to, you know, let's just take away all the foods you have. Let's figure out what's going on, what is causing this issue, and let's get to the root cause of it. So interestingly enough, kind of what shapes our microbiome? Lots of things. When we're born, the method, the way we're born versus like vaginal versus C-section impacts our microbiome. Early nutrition impacts our microbiome. And so if you're somebody who gave birth via C-section, your baby might have a more unfavorable microbiome. But knowing that information with early nutrition, there's a lot you can change. You just supplement with probiotics if you know that, right? If you're formula fed versus breastfed, if you're formula fed, you're going to need more bacteria versus breast milk, getting that naturally from mom. And so knowing this information helps you make choices that are going to be better for your children. How does the microbiome change though? Because you're like, well, if I got it when I was, if I was little, you're like, well, I was breastfed and I, you know, take probiotics or took probiotics. The human microbiome is challenged all the time. Changes with diet, stress, antibiotic use, the physiology, like I said, hormonal changes, again, lead to dysbiosis. And a dysbiotic state leads to increased intestinal permeability. And this allows contents such as bacterial metabolites and molecules, as well as bacteria themselves, to leak through the submucosa and into the systemic circulation. This can cause inflammation, pro-inflammatory cytokines. Interestingly enough, pro-inflammatory cytokines have also been associated with depression. So we keep seeing this gut-brain, brain-gut axis relationship that exists. So let's talk about depression and bacteria. Specifically, this study was actually looking at probiotics, and I found it very interesting. So human and animal studies of probiotics show similar reductions in anxiety and depressive symptoms. Human patients suffering from chronic stress were given a 3-week probiotic treatment containing bifidobacteria species. Subjects in the bottom third of the depressed scale demonstrated the most improvement with treatment with the probiotics. These patients rated an overall happier mood on daily analog scales using 6 dimensions of mood, including energetic, tired, composed, anxious, elated, depressed, clear-headed, muddled, confident, unsure, and agreeable or angry. Comparing probiotics to the antidepressant citalopram, or Cipralex, if you are in Ontario, that's the common brand. In mice, the probiotics were discovered to have similar effects. They were equally successful in anxiety reduction and were more effective in maintaining healthy metabolism and body weight. Though the researchers have not determined the mechanism of action in humans, those who studied probiotics in rats found that oral ingestion of Bifidobacterium infantis resulted in increased tryptophan, which is a serotonin precursor, and GABA. So that is pretty cool. Now the question is, do I think you should go off your antidepressants and take a probiotic? No, because I think we need to again, do some root cause medicine. I talk about, you know, pulling the rug out from under people. I would never recommend, well, anybody who's listening to this, we're not, you know, working in a patient-doctor relationship, so I'm not making any recommendations, but I would never recommend to a patient to come off of a medication that was prescribed by another practitioner, because that's not my scope of practice. But what I would do is I would help build all the foundations and lay the groundwork so that I wouldn't be pulling the rug out from under you, so that at some point we would be able to, you know, lay the foundations of diet and lifestyle and make sure that your stress is managed and all of the other pieces, and then say, well, you know what, now that you're feeling good, now that you're working out, now that you're doing all these things, let's try and take you off. Let's talk to your doctor and see what they think about this, right? Because what's the ultimate goal? Again, we ask the question, what is the end goal? What is the next move, right? Is the next move to stay on antidepressants, or is it to come off eventually when you feel better? Do you want to get to a place where you're like, huh, I feel like I could maybe manage this? And that's okay if you feel like you can't, but just some food for thought, so to speak. I want to talk about the gut and anxiety too. The gut microbiota is a key regulator within the gut-brain axis. Bacterial species can regulate the production of neurotransmitters and their precursors. So things like serotonin, GABA, and tryptophan can be made in the gut. This can secrete and upregulate essential proteins and metabolites involved in neural peptide and hormone release, such as short-chain fatty acids and brain-derived neurotrophic factor. So looking at, you know, the gut-brain axes, the development of the gut microbiome and neurotransmitters, the research has also indicated that gut microbes may also be involved in the development and function of the HPA axis, which is what we use to coordinate the stress response in the body. A dysregulated HPA axis is implicated in anxiety and depression. Typically in anxiety and depression, we also have higher levels of cortisol. And like I mentioned before, higher levels of inflammatory mediators that lead to a sustained pro-inflammatory state. Not only can the gut microbiota contribute to increases in cortisol and inflammation, but pro-inflammatory states may also compound microbiome alterations. So it goes both ways, right? Gut changes can lead to inflammation, and inflammation can lead to gut changes, right? The microbiome changes. Excessive levels of circulating cortisol and inflammatory mediators increase intestinal permeability, which we've talked about, allowing gram-negative bacteria to translocate into the bloodstream, which can go into the central nervous system. And this can impact anxiety and depression. Treating anxiety by treating the gut. Again, another study they looked at. So this was actually a meta-analysis. They looked at over 3,000 articles, 21 studies. A total of 3,334 articles were retrieved. 21 studies were included, which contained 1,500 subjects total. In the 21 studies, 15 chose probiotics as interventions to regulate intestinal microbiota, and 6 chose non-probiotic ways, such as adjusting daily diets. So, what do we conclude? Overall, 11 studies showed a positive effect on anxiety symptoms by regulating intestinal microbiome, which indicated 52% of the studies were effective. There were 5 studies that used probiotic supplements as interventions, and 6 used non-probiotic. In addition, it should be noted that 6 of 7 studies showed that regulation of the intestinal microbiota could treat anxiety symptoms with a rate of efficacy of 86%, which is fantastic. And so coming back to menopause and IBS and anxiety and depression, treat the gut is my take-home point. The last thing that I found was interesting, there was a 12-week probiotic supplementation which enhanced the diversity of neurotransmitter synthesizing bacteria and levels of neuroactive metabolites. Their results showed a potential link between probiotic-induced gut microbiota modulation and stress anxiety alleviation in stressed adults, supporting that the gut-brain axis was involved in relieving stress-related symptoms. So what do you do to help your microbiome? First of all, we have to figure out what's going on with your gut. So do you have infections? Do you have overgrowth? Normally, I will do a stool test for that, but understanding what that looks like. But then also, okay, what are the things we can do foundationally? Healthy fats. Healthy fats help make short-chain fatty acids, which can protect the gut from inflammation. Eating a variety of foods will assist diversity, getting rid of processed foods and sugar. Exercising can actually beneficially impact your microbiome, reducing alcohol, and consistent and good quality sleep, and treating the root cause of those sleep issues. So that's all I have to say about menopause and perimenopause and anxiety. I hope to see you guys next week with a new episode. Thanks.